You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Auto Workers Local 249 and Teamsters Joint Council 56. United Auto Workers Local 249, members building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world. And Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions representing 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We're proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And we thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we interviewed Stephen Hill about his new book, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. And before that, we're going to talk to Adia Wingfield. She tells us how employers screen out minorities by names and resumes. In the news, finally, Obama administration releases secret text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Worse than we feared, say unions. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Ario about 1. Oscar presses poultry companies to improve conditions. 2. OSHA proposes biggest fine in Nebraska history. And 3. Remembering fallen firefighters. Now for the news.
Today, the Obama administration finally released the text of the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership. This mammoth agreement between 12 Pacific Rim countries was negotiated and signed in secret, and will now be voted on in Congress with very limited fast-track rules, providing only 20 hours of debate and no amendments. Reaction has been predictable for groups opposed to so-called free trade agreements. Public Citizens Lori Wallach said, apparently the TPP's proponents resorted to such extreme secrecy during negotiations because the text shows that the TPP would offshore more American jobs, lower our wages, flood us with unsafe imported food, and expose our laws to attack in foreign tribunals. When the administration says it used the TPP to regenerate NAFTA, few expected that meant doubling down on the worst job-killing, wage-suppressing NAFTA terms, expanding limits on food safety, and rolling back past reforms on environmental standards and access to affordable drugs. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka said, from what we have reviewed so far, we're deeply disappointed that our policy recommendations and those of our trade reform allies in the environmental, consumer, public health, global development, and business sectors were largely ignored. He promised the hardworking families of the AFL-CIO would join with their allies to defeat the TPP. Here's just a few provisions that will disrupt working people. The Wall Street Journal: the U.S. market access concessions alone will increase our trade deficit in manufactured goods and autos and auto parts by more than $55 billion, resulting in the loss of more than 330,000 jobs. The TPP changes the rules of the origin for products to be considered made in the TPP area from 62.5%, which was under NAFTA, to 55%. This means a car could have 55% of its parts made in China and still be considered an American car. The labor chapter, which the administration is touting as a great improvement, doesn't even have binding language on forced labor. It establishes no standards for wages and working conditions. The language used for improving labor protections uses words like endeavor to encourage, such aspirational language, making nothing obligatory. It does not provide the clear protection workers in Vietnam and Brunei need to organize, collectively bargain, and raise their wages in a safe and just working environment. Despite promises, there isn't even a plan for Mexico, which is and has long been woefully out of compliance with international labor standards.
Kent Patterson of FNS News reports from the border. In a virtually unprecedented development, labor protest is widening in the maquiladora industry of Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. While worker dissatisfaction or protest is nothing new in the foreign-owned border factories that produce goods for export to the United States, previous manifestations of discontent in the generally union-free industry have usually been confined to one company at a time. But recently, movements for better pay and working conditions and union representation have emerged at four different companies: Foxconn, Lexmark, ADC CommScope, and Eaton. Hundreds of workers have participated in street protests, hunger strikes, and leafleting. "This is the time bomb going off," said Elizabeth Flores, director of Pastoral Obrera, the Ciudad Juarez Catholic Archdiocese's labor justice and human rights arm. "It's interesting to see how all the people are demonstrating." Flores spoke to FNS as ex-workers of the North Carolina-based CommScope company, a manufacturer of products for networking infrastructure like fiber optics, joined in on an October 26 demonstration at the Bridge of the Americas organized by rural human rights and environmental activists. Several former workers complained to FNS about abusive treatment by company management that included shouts, insults, and arbitrary changes in work shifts. The workers said they had been fired for forming an independent union on September 16th. Many of the former employees are single mothers like Veronica Rodriguez, who said more than 100 workers joined the new union. According to the mother of three, her earnings came out to less than $50 in base pay weekly, plus bonuses that averaged about $40 a month. "You can't get by very well. You have to look for another source of income," Rodriguez said. "We are also protesting to see if the government helps." To press their cause, Rodriguez and fellow workers have set up an encampment outside CommScope's Juarez plant. "The company isn't disposed to negotiate and doesn't want to dialogue," said Estrada, lawyer for the fired CommScope workers. "We don't know why the company fired 120 workers in an act of revenge. The company said they were fired for breaking the rules."
At today's labor media breakfast, there were lots of news clips from area unions. Here's just a few. UAW union members at Local 31 in Kansas City, Kansas, have resoundedly voted down the proposed agreement with General Motors. Production workers voted 63-37% against the deal, and skilled trade workers voted their agreement down 66-34%. Workers at Arlington, Texas GM plant have also turned it down, while three plants in Detroit accepted the new contract. One reason for the no vote appears to be that although the lower tier workers are making progress in pay equity, there's an even lower tier of temp workers who never get any justice on the job. Tony Robinson of the American Postal Workers Union reported they are in national negotiations with the U.S. Postal Service, which wants a new third bottom tier and a new even lower tier of Christmas associates. Their contract expired last month. OSHA representative Brian Wood discussed several initiatives for workers to improve employer compliance on ergonomics, amputations, and temp worker safety training. He suggested workers request the OSHA 300 logs, which give details on reported injuries and illness for each employer. If there are repeated problems in this area, then workers can anonymously call OSHA for inspection. Jeff Hayes of the Communication Workers with Jackson County Dispatchers have ratified their first union contract. So have workers with Mood Media. Meanwhile, KU Med Center dispatchers are facing some very anti-union attitudes from their new management at the Med Center. United Auto Workers 249 did a gate collection for families of the two firefighters killed last month and raised $11,000. And Teamsters fighting to save their pensions from being cut will be rallying again on November 19th at noon in front of the Kansas City Star to make sure they get coverage. About 800 showed up last Thursday for a rally. The news tonight was read by Jacqueline Hams, Ariana Eckel, and I'm Molly Madden.
It's been raining for a couple of days now. My dad's pond is overflowing. The orange fish are at the back door. The toxic flood water is glowing. And we shake our heads and get in. Forget those things we said. Making love under the stars. I go back and forth daily about us and them and who's really to blame. But I think it's pretty clear here who has got the most to gain. From a divided up society that's terrified of honesty, and we can't discern our enemies, so we give them our complicity. They make beer and we buy it. They make cars and we drive them. They build walls and we just give in. They build boxes that we live in. They make gods for us to pray to. Jobs to give our days to. Binaries of gender. But they won't have my surrender, no. The TV, they say don't take your life so seriously. I say this is the only way that I know how to be. Cause we need passion, not fashion. We need food, not lawns. We need action, not factions. Everyone here to be singing along. We need stories, not glory. We need friends, not fans. We need guitars, not rock stars. We need more than just loud, drunk, straight, white male punk bands. So let's destroy out of love.
That was Evan Greer singing Never Surrender. Today, our segment, we're going to discuss what's in a name and how that influences the employment process. We will examine the role a name plays in employment if you are Latino, Asian, Black in America. Joining us later on in this call will be Adia Harvey Winfield. She's a professor at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. To start off, I'm going to give you a scenario. There was a movie a while back called Coach Carter, and it was about a pregnant teenage African-American girl who was asked what she was going to name her baby. She said, Loquisha. Her friend replied, well, your baby might as well be named food stamps. The point is clear. Loquisha is a Black name, and names determine your destiny. Recently, Raven Simone, a talk show co-host of The View, commented that she would never hire a person with a name she views as Africanized. This episode of the talk show then included a video of children saying ghetto Black names such as Philandra and Elephantisha. Today on the show, Jacob White and myself, Shaikalyn Hams, we will be exploring discrimination and what's in the name. And there may be some other avenues that we will explore that goes along with this. We wanted to talk about the applicants and what they need to do to overcome obstacles because of their name and employment.
Yeah, so some of the things that I've heard about and I read recently, there was a New York Times Room for Debate about this. And one thing that I've heard that people do sometimes will be they'll leave things off their resume if it's going to give away something about them that they don't think the employer is going to want to know. Or another thing that people do sometimes is just use their initials as for their first name on their resume if they're worried that their name might be discriminated against in the hiring process. And there's just a lot of things that employers can sort of naturally use in order to study this. One thing that we've known about, and this is popular in the college application process too, is I went to a college that they claim to be need blind in their admission process, which means that they don't see how much income your parents make before they decide whether or not to let you into the school. But they do check what your address is, and your address and your name can say a lot about what background you're from. And so now we have Adia Professor Wingfield on the air, and it looks like we're going to be able to proceed. So I'll hand it over to Shaikalyn.
Okay, Dr. Wingfield, thank you for joining us. And I called you Dr. Wingfield. Do you have your doctorate? Did I misquote that?
Do.
You do? Okay, great. Okay. Dr. Wingfield, we're so glad that you joined us today. And I'd like to tell our listening audience that Dr. Wingfield, she's a professor at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Professor Wingfield is also involved in community outreach, quantitative research, and more. She is the author of several articles and books, just to name a few. No More Invisible Man, Race and Gender in Men's Work, Being Black but Not Being Too Black. Ms. Wingfield, Dr. Wingfield, it appears that employers are discriminating against certain ethnic groups because of their name, when in fact the employer is actually concerned about what community the applicant lives in and the socioeconomic climate of that community. What are your thoughts on this?
Yes, I think that's what we can infer from the research. There are several studies that show that workers who apply to jobs who have names that are stereotypically associated with black communities find that they have lower chances and lower opportunities for access to those jobs. And it's not just limited to black Americans. That studies have shown also that for Latino professionals or Latino workers, changing their names on their resumes can actually result in greater access to callbacks and more access to opportunities. It's unfortunate because names are not necessarily indicative or even indicative at all of occupational performance and a person's success in the workplace. But this offers a way for employers to engage in processes that can often result in deleterious consequences for minority workers.
Okay. What can an applicant do to overcome having obstacles because of their name? Do you have suggestions?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer, I think. Obviously, we know of some stories where applicants may be careful about how they present their names on vitas, their resumes. They may go by middle names or use initials, things like that. But I think that doing those types of strategies offers a really temporary solution to a bigger problem. Because if you make those sorts of changes, you may have access to more types of jobs and more types of occupational opportunities, but you may still be likely to face a lot of the problems and issues that plague minority workers in the workplace at large. So changing your name and engaging in these types of solutions may be short-term strategies that offer a bit of success, but I worry about their applicability and their long-term prospects for creating real change.
Okay, and today I ran across an article on the web. There was a young man, his name was Jose, he's Latino, and he never received any callbacks, and so he made a choice to drop one of the consonants in his name. So he went from Jose to Joe, and he got lots of, you know, return calls and so forth. However, it became a legal issue when his name did not match up with his Social Security number when he did secure employment.
Yes, and that's kind of an example of one of the issues that can present itself. So you have this story of this guy who drops a letter from his name and sees that there's a change in the extent to which he receives callback and interest from potential employers. You mentioned a potential legal outcome that can come from that, but again, I have to wonder if this is the strategy that's necessary for this individual to have access to a wider range of occupations, then what happens once they do get their foot in the door? I guess, in other words, the question that I'm raising and the issue that concerns me is if an employer is likely to discriminate based on perceptions that they have about the person's name, then it seems to me that that workplace may not necessarily be a very hospitable one for workers of color at large.
Okay. You know, I was looking at the history of within the African-American community back in the 1960s. That's when the change in names started to emerge. Do you think this is a symbol of resistance to the West European influence and also a resistance to conformity?
Well, I think the literature that I have seen on this topic does suggest that rather than the stereotypical assumption that's often made, which is that for black families in particular, these creative names indicate a lack of knowledge or an unwillingness to assimilate or to be part of the society, to a part of the broader society, that in other cases they may simply indicate efforts to offer children individuality and uniqueness and ways of responding to a broader society that has, in many cases, not been very welcoming or hospitable to people of color.
Okay. Now, I have another question for you. Are there causes and consequences to distinctively having a very distinctively ethnic name? And again, what can we do to overcome that, or is there a solution?
Well, I think that depends on who we're talking about, right? Because one thing that I think is important to emphasize is that when we're talking about distinctive names, the adverse consequences that attach to those tend to be more pronounced if we're talking about people of color. So, for example, if we hear the name, I think one of the most well-known studies that talks about this specifically uses the examples of Jamal and Lakeisha. If we hear that there's a person who's applying for a high-profile position and that's their name, the assumption is that that person is not qualified. I think if I remember correctly, Raven Simone was on The View recently and got into some hot water because she made some statements about how she wouldn't hire someone.
Oh, yes, she did.
Yeah, with an unusual name. But again, the assumptions of lack of qualification don't seem to apply across the board. I can think of a number of white individuals who are successful, who are well-known, who are highly visible, where I've never heard suggestions that their unusual names marked them as people who were not serious or not capable or not qualified. Mitt Romney is one example. Mitt is not a very common name that I don't believe that's a very common name, but I don't remember also hearing that being named Mitt indicated that he was somehow unqualified or less serious or less suitable for running for the presidency. Similarly, I moved here from Georgia. One of the senators in my home state until he retired was Saxby Chambliss. Saxby, again, is not necessarily what you'd consider a common, everyday, frequently heard name, but there aren't assumptions made based on that Saxby was unfit for the state, unfit for the Senate, or someone who was not suitable for politics, or that his name indicated that he was strange or inappropriately qualified or something like that. So I think what you're describing is true, but I think that what we have to be cognizant of are the ways that these ideas about names and what they suggest about the person owning that name are really ways in which racial perceptions can attach onto other markers in ways that aren't necessarily overt and explicit, but still function to create these types of inequalities.
Recently, during 9/11, I have a sister. Her name is Yasmin. And she incurred a problem. She's part American Indian and black, and her last name is Hams. She went to get on a flight, and she was pulled over. She has a tendency to look more Mideasterner. And then given the fact of her name and she was not allowed to get on board. So that's another thing where it's not just blacks and Latinos and Asians that are incurring these problems. It's also the Arab community, Mideastern community.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right, right? And again, what part of what this underscores, again, is this idea that the assumptions that we have about names and what they signify don't uniformly extend across the board to all racial groups. They extend to groups that are socially marginalized and in the racial minority in some way, people who appear to be Middle Eastern, people who are African American, people who are Latino, people who are Asian American. When we encounter whites with names that are unusual, the same presumptions of being unqualified or being incapable or being intellectually less rigorous, those types of stereotypes often don't apply to whites with unusual names in the same way that they do to people of color with unusual names.
So, Professor Wingfield, I'm Jacob. I'm joining you guys, and I just had a question about Jeb and Newt and Mitt and names like that. One other thing we have to consider, and especially when we're talking about their job prospects, is that Mitt's last name is Romney, and Jeb's last name is Bush, and their fathers, you know, we're able to get them in the door to some extent. So how much does that the legacy of nepotism and stuff sort of counteract their having unusual names?
I think that's a really good point, right? And in those two particular cases, then yes, that can be something that can help to perhaps cushion or ameliorate potential fallout. But again, think of the other example that I cited, Saxby Chambliss, who, to my knowledge, doesn't come from a political family with a great deal of clout or influence. But at the same time, he was my senator for most of the time that I lived in Georgia, and while I wasn't overly invested in state politics, I followed the news pretty regularly and don't remember ever hearing people make assumptions or concerns about the fact that his unusual name indicated a lack of ability or skill or intelligence or what have you. I think you're right that for people who come from political families where they are the beneficiaries of a lot of influence and power, like Mitt Romney, like Jeb Bush, then that often can be very advantageous and pave the way for mitigating a lot of potential challenges that they might face. But I do think that this is a story that connects to a lot of our generalized racial perceptions about qualifications and inherent abilities, skills, and intellectualism.
When you have an ethnic-sounding name, what percentage of those individuals actually receive a callback when they're applying for jobs?
I'm not sure. I think we'd have to look at the precise literature that studies this exactly. And I don't even remember from the study about Jamal and LaQuisha versus Erica or Emma or whatever the names were, if they broke the information down into percentages. But I do remember that it was statistically more likely to show that people with those particular names weren't receiving the same types of attention.
Right. There's a young man. He has a Spanish name. He's Latino descent, and he feels that potential employers call him back, assuming that he speaks fluent Spanish because of his name.
Did you say that they assume that he speaks fluent Spanish because of his name?
Yes.
And that he does get callbacks from potential employers?
Mm-hmm.
Right, yes. And I think it's important to reiterate, this is not to suggest that if you have a name that sounds ethnic, you won't get a job or you won't get a callback, right? But the idea is that these types of names can work to people's disadvantages in a broader, more aggregate sense. I wouldn't suggest that if your name is Jose or Ahmad or something like that, then that just automatically means you're destined for unemployment. Obviously, that's not necessarily true. But this research does suggest that those names do have an impact on the ways that employers in certain fields and occupations may be likely to perceive your abilities and your skills, which I think is problematic because, again, naming is not necessarily correlated or connected to those things.
Right. And, you know, even in my case, when I started doing some research on you, I automatically assumed that you were Caucasian. And today when I Googled your name, your picture came up, you were African American. So, you know, this bias, this racial bias that we do, it goes both ways, and we sometimes unconsciously do it. We're getting a little bit short on time. We're at that 2-minute mark. And so I wanted to ask you, do you have advice, thoughts, or resources for our listeners with challenging names as to how to overcome and move past name discrimination in employment?
Well, I think this type of discrimination is connected to broader issues of discrimination at large. If I had a quick, easy solution for how to fix that, I would sell it and retire early.
Okay.
But I think that there is a lot of literature that does talk about the challenges that people face, and I think that being familiar with this type of research can help for people to become aware of what they're up against and what they're going to be encountering. So I'm familiar with a lot of the literature in sociology that does talk about these issues of not just name discrimination, but employment discrimination and patterns of inequality at large. I think you mentioned earlier my own book, No More Invisible Man, looks at this from the perspective of black professional men and the ways in which race and gender have an impact on the social processes that affect their professional experiences. My colleague Marianne Cooper at Stanford has done a lot of work in this area as well. I think her work is very interesting. My other colleague, mm-hmm. Vincent Rossigno, is at Ohio State University. He's done a lot of research on race and gender and processes of inequality at work, as has my colleague Don Tomaskiewicz-Devey at University of Massachusetts and Amherst, and my colleague and friend Christine Williams at University of Texas in Austin. So these are all some sociologists who, like mm-hmm. me, are engaged with these questions and doing, I think, important and really innovative and interesting work, and your listeners may find their research very helpful for their own occupational process.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Winfield, for presenting your research and your perspective about what's in the name.
Thank
we
you
appreciate
for
you taking your time out of your busy schedule to share with our listeners your research. Thank you, and call us again. I am Shaikalyn Hams, and I'm with Jacob White, and you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Charles Glass on the Syrian conflict.
Randy Spivak on public land fossil fuel extraction.
Richard Wolff on Bernie Sanders' discussion of democratic socialism.
And a summary of the week's underreported news.
On Between the Lines.
Friday morning at 9.
Khadija, I heard about this radio show. It's about race.
What? A show about race?
Yeah, on the radio. It's on the community radio station, KKFI.
You're supposed to talk about that around your kitchen table.
Yeah, and that's what I thought, but it's actually on the radio talking about race and racial things.
What time is it?
It's 7 o'clock Thursday.
And what's the name of this show?
Khadija and the White Guy.
Say what?
Yeah, Keith Washburn and...
Khadija Hardaway.
See you then, Thursday night at 7 o'clock.
Right. Hello, this is Jacob White for the Heartland Labor Forum, and today I'm going to be talking to Stephen Hill, so here's a brief introduction. In an article published yesterday about how tech billionaires are trying to Uberize the trucking industry, the journalist Mark Ames wrote, "For all the internet's initial promise of smashing traditional hierarchies and creating horizontal structures that democratize power and politics, the reality is that the internet economy has centralized power and wealth, and the political economy on a scale not really seen since the railroads destroyed the old economy and quickly created hugely centralized new industries, which centralized into trusts and created a class of oligarchs with outsized wealth and power that no democracy could survive." Joining us today is Stephen Hill, a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, who has studied and experimented with the so-called sharing economy and is the author of Raw Deal: How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers, from St. Martin's Press. He is here to tell us about the negative effects of technological disruption for workers in the United States. Thanks so much for joining us, Stephen.
My pleasure.
So, one of the most surprising and convincing parts of your book is when you explain just how much the ideological underpinnings of Ross Ulbricht and the Silk Road mirror those of leaders of Uber and Airbnb and other companies like them. Can you tell us a bit about Ulbricht's story?
Well, Ulbricht was the head of the website called Silk Road, which was a black market website. You could buy all sorts of drugs on there. You could buy guns. You could buy just about anything that was illegal, including, by some reports, you could even hire hitmen on that website. And what was remarkable to me was how, if you took the words of Ross Ulbricht and you put them up against, you know, words coming from other CEOs like Brian Chesky from Airbnb or Travis Kalanick from Uber, and you said, okay, which one of these quotes is coming from which of these CEOs? You couldn't tell one from the other. They all were filled with this notion that somehow what they're doing is revolutionary, that they're pulling together a community of people going up against the government, and the government is evil, and you have to somehow fight back against government. And, you know, so there was just a lot of parallels there. And Silicon Valley in general is a place where there's kind of a pirate culture there, you know, always trying to get away with beating government and disrupting things and creating chaos. And out of chaos will come good things eventually, but not right now. I mean, there's just so many interesting parallels like that that I explored them in the book a little bit. And it was quite interesting, I thought.
And you term people like this techno sapiens. Is Ross Ulbricht a techno sapien?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Silk Road was using the web to connect people. You know, and you know, sometimes a sharing economy is called a peer to peer. It connects you to me without any middle person for buying and selling. And Silk Road did that extremely well. I mean, if you went on their website, it was just like going on Amazon. You could buy all sorts of things. It just happened to be all those things were illegal. And so it was an interesting example of how, you know, if you take the kind of mentality, the Ayn Rand fundamentalist mentality, libertarian mentality of Silicon Valley, if you take it to its extreme, you end up at a place like Silk Road. And many of these companies today, I mean, they're not as extreme as Silk Road, but they are encouraging lawbreaking. They are encouraging not paying your taxes. You know, Airbnb, it doesn't say to its host, look, you know, if you're renting out your place, you're actually by law supposed to pay a hotel tax for renting out your place. And so you're going to have to do that, and we're going to facilitate that. Airbnb doesn't say that. Instead, they just ignore it, and they're fine with their guests ignoring it. And that means cities who depend on that hotel and occupancy tax for, you know, revenue for local programs, they're losing money because people are staying with Airbnb instead of staying with local hotels. And it works the same way with Uber. You know, taxi companies pay what's called a livery tax for being able to operate a taxi company. Uber doesn't pay it. It doesn't make its drivers pay it. And so all these different companies, as well as the people who are working for these companies, are in a real sense putting one over on the government by not following laws and not paying their taxes.
Ulbricht is also seen as a more extreme version than Airbnb and Uber, but he's also seen as a visionary of the underground economy. You kind of mentioned the whole pirate identity that's been growing in Silicon Valley. So, and more broadly than just Silicon Valley, but what is the underground economy?
Well, the underground economy is, you know, everywhere from the gray economy to the black economy, people working under the table, people getting paid in cash instead of, you know, through their bank accounts, because it can't be tracked by the government. And then, you know, ultimately these sorts of people don't pay taxes on their income, which means government has less money to do good things with it, and, you know, have services for people, for elderly people and for children and these sorts of things. And, you know, we're living in a time where there's a rather interesting dilemma where our economic measurements aren't really capturing what's going on in the labor force. And I'll give you one example. According to traditional economic theory, when the unemployment rate comes down, the employment rate is supposed to go up. They're inversely related, like a seesaw. When one goes up, the other side goes down. And so that's how it's supposed to work. But in fact, the time we've been living in, the unemployment rate is coming down, but the employment rate is not going up. That means the unemployment rate is coming down because the workers who were unemployed before, they've quit looking for work. They're what's called discouraged workers, and as a result, they don't show up in economic statistics. And so it looks like the unemployment rate is going down, yet the employment rate is not going up. And you know, estimates are that since the Great Recession in 2008, 2009. About 12 million U.S. workers are no longer in the labor force. They're just, no one knows what happened to them. No one knows how they're making money. You know, clearly a certain number of them have drifted into the gray economy. Some of them have drifted into the black economy. And some of them are using sharing economy, gig economy companies to make some money here and there. I mean, they're basically piecing things together any way they can to make a living, almost going back to the time, like in the 19th century, where people did piecework and, you know, didn't have regular jobs that they reported to. They just did a little bit of this, a little bit of that, just, you know, sort of stitching together any kind of way to make a living.
And I wanted to go back to the 18th and 19th centuries. Before the rise of capitalism, there was a guild system where you would have to be an apprentice for a while and then you could join the guild. And from then until about now, we've had the relationship between capital and labor, but mostly on the individual level, the relationship has been between a worker, their union, and a single capitalist firm. One major point of your book is that this relationship is being transformed. So now we're moving towards a freelance society with 1099 workers. Can you tell us what a 1099 worker is?
A 1099 worker refers to a contractor or a freelancer or in some cases a temp worker who is not regularly employed, and they fill out what's called a 1099 form that goes to the IRS. And the 1099 refers to the IRS form that's used for this type of worker, as opposed to a regularly employed worker where they use a W-2 form with the IRS. So what we're seeing is the rise of what I call the 1099 economy. More and more workers are becoming contractors, freelancers, temps, and of course these sorts of workers are treated very differently than regularly employed part-time workers. Those sorts of workers don't have any safety net, so they're not getting any health care from their employer. They're not getting any Social Security or Medicare. They're not even getting injured worker compensation or unemployment compensation. If they get injured on the job, they not only lose their job, but they also have to pay for that injury themselves because there's no injured worker compensation. So these are the sorts of things that that more and more workers are being subjected to. From the labor's, from the employer's perspective, the reason why you go to this is because you're saving 30% of your costs by not paying for all the safety net benefits that these workers have. But from the worker's point of view, suddenly you're really out there on your own with very little support. All you have is your wage, and in many cases for these sorts of jobs, the wages aren't very good. And so increasingly employers are using this as a way to cut their costs. And I'll give you an example. The pharmaceutical company Merck, they had a plant in Philadelphia. They sell the plant to another company. The company lays off all 400 workers, then hires back the exact same 400 workers and proceeds to make the same drugs for Merck as before, just with the same workers now as contractors instead of regularly employed employees. So this is the type of, more and more companies are doing these sorts of tactics in order to get rid of regularly employed workers and to go to these contractors. And it's just a race to the bottom. And it's going to undermine the middle class as this becomes more and more a tactic that's being used by more and more employers.
A lot of UAW union members have been pretty critical of the two-tier system, and you mentioned an even more extreme version of that at a Nissan plant. Is that right, where they have workers working next to temp workers who don't get the same benefits?
Yes, that's right. In the book, there's a story of a worker. His name is Chris Young. He works at a Nissan plant in Tennessee. And, you know, he's working alongside a lot of other workers. Those workers are wearing the Nissan shirt because they work directly for Nissan, but Chris Young does not. He works for a contractor. Even though he's doing the exact same work as all the other workers, he's a contractor, and for that he gets paid half the wage. He has no safety net, no job security, and, you know, life is really hard for him, even though he's doing the exact same work. And he's a temp worker, but there's a new name for temp workers like him. They're called permatemps because oftentimes they're working there at the same position 3, 4, 5, 6 years. Not, you know, you think a temporary worker would just be for a few months, and yet these workers are staying in these positions for years. And at this point, you know, half of the workers in auto plants are temp workers. And since the Great Recession collapse in 2008-2009, about a fifth of the jobs that have been created in the United States are temporary jobs like this. And so this is the fastest growing part of the labor force, and that should be extremely alarming because these are not very good jobs. Workers working these jobs are not treated well.
And not only do we have a rise in temporary jobs, but we also have a rise in people who maybe are renting out a room in their house and then driving a Uber and then also doing sales for, you know, a third of the day or something like that, which you were pretty critical of how the freelancers are approaching that sort of attitude in your book. You want to explain what's wrong with having to work three jobs, if that.
Well, I have a story in my book of Maria Fernandez. She was she worked for Dunkin' Donuts, and she was a part-time worker. She worked for three different Dunkin' Donuts franchises because none of the single franchise wanted to give her enough hours at work, because if you go above too many hours, then you have to start giving a safety net to the workers. So instead, each franchise would give her just a part-time work. That way they didn't have to pay her any of the safety net benefits. And so she had to have three of these jobs in order to live. And it just kept her running from one to the other. She was sometimes doing overnight shifts and morning shifts and day shifts, having a hard time getting enough time to even sleep. She just drove up and down the New Jersey Turnpike from one Dunkin' Donuts store to another. And she, in order to make sure she didn't run out of gas, she began keeping a gas can in the car with her. And one morning, early morning, about 5:30 in the morning, she pulled into a Wawa convenience store to get a few hours of sleep. They found her later that afternoon. She had died in her car of asphyxiation from the gas fumes. The gas can somehow had gotten knocked over. And so she died from this asphyxiation. She was still in her Dunkin' Donuts uniform when she died. And this created a bit of a national outcry because it made people really wonder, what kind of economy are we creating here? What kind of jobs are we providing for people when someone would have to work three different part-time jobs at the same business? I mean, you know, if Dunkin' Donuts had given her just one job that, you know, that pay for more hours at one of the stores instead of making her go to three different ones, she would have had a safety net. She would have had a better job. She wouldn't have been running up and down the turnpike. But instead, the incentive for the Dunkin' Donuts, which is a very profitable business, the CEO of Dunkin' Donuts makes millions of dollars a year, and yet they couldn't even give her a decent enough job so that she didn't have to work under these types of living conditions. So, you know, this is the reality for more and more workers in this American economy.
You spend some time in the book talking about how activists and organizers are trying to respond to this. You interview David Rolfe, who's a SEIU Seattle, pretty well-known and respected organizer, and your guys' conversations seem to be building towards the idea of a third wave of labor organizing or labor 3.0. What's an example of labor 3.0 and how it can be effective?
Some examples are the National Domestic Workers Alliance, some of the taxi cab companies, or not companies, but alliances of workers, of taxi cab drivers. And, you know, these aren't unions in the traditional sense in that they are trying to negotiate a contract with an employer. Instead, what they're doing is they're trying to raise the public awareness of how these workers are treated and then trying to get laws passed in order to make their working conditions better. So the domestic workers, for example, managed in New York to pass a law that says that if you work above 30 hours for any particular employer, that you get some, you know, some paid vacation time and paid sick leave and these sorts of things. And that's all really good. But the problem is that, you know, once you set a number like that, you say, okay, above 30 hours you get this, below 30 hours you don't get anything, the employer makes sure you only get 29 hours, you know?
Yeah.
That's the real problem with that approach. And so what I've proposed in my book, Raw Deal, is another way of going about this. And what it would do is it would require all businesses, regardless of whether they're hiring contractors or whether they're hiring you know, regularly employed workers, they would still pay a certain amount into a fund, what I call an individual security account for that worker, that would be prorated to the number of hours that that worker works for that business. And they would pay about, you know, it works out to about $2 per hour above the wage, and that money would then be used to purchase the safety net that that worker needs. This is a much better way to go about doing this than, you know, having these sort of cutoffs where above this amount you get a safety net, below it you don't, and all the loopholes that come with that. You know, these are the sorts of, I think, innovations that we need to go. Creating portable benefits for a multi-employer world where you have more and more people who are working for multiple employers.
We only have about 45 seconds left, but I would like to ask you, we've talked about how to lift up the workers in this new economy. What about reining in Uber and Airbnb? What can we do from a regulatory perspective real quickly?
Well, I think you have to make them follow existing laws. I mean, Uber is a taxi company, and you already have laws on the books for taxi companies. Make them follow those laws. Airbnb, they should be paying their taxes and following local laws. I mean, Airbnb has become a loophole for professional real estate operatives to take over the housing stock, and instead of renting it out to local residents, renting it out to tourists. That more, if you look at Airbnb's business model, where their revenue is coming from, more and more, that's where Airbnb's revenue is coming, is these professionals. It's not coming from regular people who are just renting out a spare room in their home, and no one has a problem with that. But the professionals are invading this platform and turning it into something that it was never meant to be. Airbnb at this point, unfortunately, has drifted very far from its origins, and local governments need to really crack down on it, or it's going to take over your housing stock.
Stephen Hill is the author of Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers, from St. Martin's Press. Please go out and get the book, and Stephen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says there's sickness for safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
First, eat chicken. Oxfam presses poultry producers to improve conditions, from the pump handle at scienceblogs.com/thepumphandle for October 27th. The anti-poverty group Oxfam America wants consumers to help poultry workers. Oxfam is calling on consumers to use their purchasing power to demand better working conditions for the 250,000 individuals who work in U.S. poultry processing plants. The target of their demands? The four firms that control about 60% of the poultry market: Tyson, Pilgrim's, Perdue, and Sanderson Farms. Explains Minora Sinclair, director of Oxfam America's U.S. program, there is a growing community of consumers who are paying attention to where their food is coming from, not only about food safety and the inhumane treatment of animals, but about the people who harvest and process our food. On October 27th, Oxfam launched a campaign and released a report, Lives on the Line, the Human Cost of Cheap Chicken, to draw attention to the low wages and unsafe working conditions of the $50 billion poultry industry. It's an illusion of choice, Oxfam notes. If you buy chicken almost anywhere in the U.S., you are almost certainly buying from one of these companies. The top four companies produces hundreds of different products and market under at least 30 different brand names. The harsh working conditions described in the Oxfam report and captured in video were documented recently by OSHA. Poultry workers on processing lines make thousands of repetitive motions each shift to convert whole chickens into fillets, tenders, nuggets that are so popular in America's lunchboxes and dinner plates. When poultry workers are injured on the job, many are penalized, denied appropriate treatment, and challenged when they filed workers' compensation claims. Most poultry processing workers earn wages that place them near the poverty line. As in Oxfam's practice, the four firms named in the report were contacted this summer and invited to hear Oxfam's findings. Tyson Foods was the only company to respond. For more information about the campaign and to sign the petition, go to www.oxfamamerica.org. Next, OSHA proposes biggest fine in Nebraska history, from the Lincoln Journal Star at journalstar.com for October 14th. Moments before a blast ripped through the rail car on April 14, 2015, A check for the air quality inside indicated a serious risk of explosion, according to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, despite the warning Nebraska Rail Car Cleaning Services sent two employees into the rail car to work without monitoring the air continually for explosive hazards, as required, nor providing the employees with emergency retrieval equipment or properly fitting respirators, the agency said in announcing the fines. The explosion blew the rail car's escape ladder off and killed the two men, trapping one inside and hurling the other off the top of the car. A third employee was injured. The workers who died were Dallas Folk and Adrian Lepore. Our hearts go out to the families of these workers whose deaths were so senseless and preventable, David Michaels, Assistant Secretary of Labor for OSHA, said in a news release. This isn't the first time this employer put its workers' lives at risk, but OSHA will do everything in its power to ensure it is the last. The company faces penalties of $963,000. OSHA also placed the company in the agency's Severe Violator Enforcement Program. The company has 15 business days from the receipt of its citations and penalties to comply, request an informal conference with OSHA's area director, or contest the findings. Finally, the International Association of Firefighters Local 42 announced with a heavy heart the line of duty deaths of two firefighters on October 12th, fire apparatus operator Larry Leggio and firefighter John Mesh. They died following a sudden wall collapse while protecting neighboring structures from the Kansas City Independence Avenue fire after rescuing residents. Donations to the families should be made to IAFF Local 42 Community Assistance, 6320 Manchester Avenue, Suite 42A, Kansas City, Missouri, 64133. Online contributions can be made through IAFF42.org. As Kansas City Mayor Sly James stated, unfortunately, situations like this bring home to all of us the danger that firefighters and police officers confront every day and what the consequences of those dangers are. This is Mary Ariel for Safety First.
Heartland Labor Forum Calendar, November 5th, 2015. What's happening in Missouri Corrections? Empower Missouri's First Friday Lunch. Friday, November 6th at 11:30 a.m. at the Westport Flea Market. Empty Bowls KC, a grassroots effort by local artists and craftspeople to feed the hungry here in Kansas City with a benefit for harvesters, on Friday, November 6th at 6 p.m. Blueprints for Freedom, a play about Bayard Rustin and the 1963 Civil Rights March, November 6th through the 15th at the Copacan Stage in H&R Block Building downtown. Fast Food Worker Mobilization, Save the KC Minimum Wage, Tuesday, November 10th at 5:30 p.m. at Barney Alice Plaza. Wyandotte County, Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast, Saturday, November 21st, 8:15 for breakfast, 9:15 for program. Rally to Stop the Rush for Pension Cuts, November 19th at high noon at the Kansas City Star.
And you can find our calendar at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find our archived shows and our upcoming shows. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called Sheet Metal Workers and Sierra Club Team Up to Demand Missouri Move Toward Energy Efficiency, and What's Up with Auto Bargaining. We're going to have some auto workers on talking about their expectations on the contract. These are Ford workers who haven't gotten a contract yet. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special, which is Khadijah and the White Guy, followed by Shots in the Night.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.